Welcome to the Physics 123 lecture for April 1st, 2013. I hope you guys are ready. Exam 2 is this Thursday, April 4th at 8 a.m. It'll be in Dewey, 1101. I'm going to announce the Q&A session very soon. I'll try to get that email out to you as short as I can. Have you made out your formula sheet yet? Hope you're ready for it. I hate the fact that I won't be there this Thursday when it's administered. At any rate, go to page 2 in the slides. Of course, I'm just kidding. You're not having your test on April the 4th. It's April 11th. But you have to remember, this is my April 1st lecture, so I have to try to be somewhat obnoxious. Exam 2 is actually happening on April 11th at 8 in the morning in Dewey 1101, and I will send you more information shortly. Although you'll see the cutoff for the material will be in today's lecture. It is not actually April 1st for me. It's Sunday for me. It's the middle of the night for you guys on your Saturday night. It is cold and dreary here in Tokai, Japan, which is where I'm sitting. I have a link, if you're interested, on page 2, a link to the public web page for the experiment that I am here working on. It's called T2K. So you could have fun poking around the website if you wish. At any rate, that's not why we're here. We are here to talk about quantum theory. And last time, in fact, I hope you'll agree, we sort of made a mess. If you go to slide 3, last time we saw that things are a bit of a confusing mess. And we've spent most of the term establishing the fact that light is a wave, and we've been studying that. And light has always, people known for a long time that light exhibited wave characteristics, and Maxwell really showed us the essence of light in its wave-like description. So in Maxwell's equations, you can derive the fact that the electric and magnetic fields satisfy wave equations. You can use the coupled differential equations that Maxwell came up with and actually derive the characteristics of the waves, the wave characteristics that we see. You can derive optics. So we've done bits and pieces of this. But around 1900, people confronted a number of things which showed that light, the wave description of light was actually insufficient to account for some of the observable things. Some of the experimental things people had observed. So, for example, people had looked at the spectrum of light emitted by objects as a function of temperature. So this would be the radiant intensity, so not reflected light, which we know as blackbody radiation. And in 1900, Planck was able to derive an equation which described the blackbody spectrum perfectly, whereas classical efforts had failed miserably. And in the midst of as part of his derivation, Planck used the assumption that light comes in little quanta, and that the energy of each of those quanta is proportional to the frequency of the light. And that constant of proportionality we now call Planck's constant. And about 5 years later, Einstein used this basic thought of light being in quanta and explained the photoelectric effect, which was basically the energy and intensity of, the energy distribution of electrons emitted from metals with light shining on them. So the description covers both the intensity and the energy of the electrons. Some years later, 1923, Arthur Compton was able to also use the photon picture of light to explain Compton scattering. So that would be the change in the angle, the change in the wavelength and the angle of light scattering off of free electrons. All three of these things were not understood using classical physics and required the use of the particulate nature of light. And interestingly, in all three of these things, the same proportionality constant between the energy and the frequency were found. So there's really no question that light also has particulate characteristics. So we're stuck with the fact that light is a wave and light is a particle, and, well, we just sort of have to deal with it. Really, whether you look at light as a wave or a particle largely depends on what it is you're actually asking, and you use the model that works well. And the fact that we're uncomfortable with it is really perhaps a limitation in our imagination as much as anything else. Let's go to slide 4. In the mid-20s, a French graduate student named Louis de Broglie sort of thought, well, if light can have wave and particle characteristics, maybe matter can have not only particle characteristics, but also wave characteristics. And he hypothesized that if you have any particle, including ones with mass, that lambda is equal to h over the momentum of the particle. And we talked about this last time, so I'm not going to motivate that here. But if we assume this is true, we can use this quantity to calculate the de Broglie, what's known as the de Broglie wavelength, which is the wavelength that satisfies this equation. So if we look at the de Broglie wavelength of a baseball moving at 100 miles per hour, so this would be a very good professional baseball pitch, a good fastball, for example. And I actually don't remember the mass of a baseball, but for simplicity, let's just say it's a kilogram. So let's take the 100 miles per hour, and you can look at the bottom of page 4. I'd convert the 100 miles per hour into meters per second because I want to use the MKS units. And then if we calculate lambda is equal to h over p, you can look up Planck's constant. Usually when you look it up, you'll find a table where it's listed in joule seconds. That actually works well for macroscopic objects like this. Typically, though, for many of the things that we do where we're dealing with H, any sort of subatomic particles and atoms and things like that, you'll often want to actually use H in units of EV seconds. So, of course, a joule is equal to 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19. I'm sorry, an electron volt is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 joules, so one can do the conversions. At any rate, if we use the Planck's constant in terms of joule seconds and divide it by the momentum of the baseball, 1 kilogram times 45 meters per second, then we end up with 1.4 times 10 to the minus 35 meters. All right, think about that. That's really small, 10 to the minus 25 angstroms, right? I mean, this is so small. So if you calculate the de Broglie wavelength for macroscopic objects, you find that it's extraordinarily small. And this means that on a daily basis, we don't need to worry about the wave-like characteristics of macroscopic objects. When a baseball is thrown, it will not diffract because its wavelength is so small relative to everything else that it encounters. However, we can now ask, what is the de Broglie wavelength of something like an electron? Well, I mean, say a 100 electron volt electron. So this would be an electron you would form by accelerating it through a potential difference of 100 volts. And one question to ask, just to see if we can calculate it most simply, as to whether we have to worry about relativity or not. And remember, the relativistic effects become relevant when the speed of an object approaches that of light. But if it's small compared to the speed of light, you really just don't need to worry about it. So if we take our 100 eV electron and we convert it into joules, and we set that equal to 1/2 mv squared, as you can see where I have a blue A in a circle, we can calculate the velocity for the electron using the mass of the electron, 9.1 times 10 to the minus 31 kilograms. And when we do that, we get 5.9 times 10 to the 6 meters per second, and that is less than 2% of the speed of velocity, so of the velocity of light. So we say that this electron is non-relativistic. Because of that, we can now use the classical description of momentum, and again, we take h and divide by the momentum using the velocity we just calculated, and we get that the de Broglie wavelength of this electron is approximately 1.2 angstroms, or 1.2 times 10 to the minus 10 meters, so 0.1 nanometers. I don't know how much this means to you, but there's a scale that you should sort of keep in mind, and why we call it this, we'll see in a moment. Something that's known as the Bohr radius, and it's basically a measure of the size of the ground state hydrogen atom radius, and that's about 0.53 angstroms. So you can see that, and the size of the hydrogen atom, for example, is sort of a scale for size of an atom. And so you can see that the wavelength of this de Broglie, the de Broglie wavelength of this 100 eV electron, is really on the order of the size of an atom. And so so this is something that in principle might be observable. So as you look at subatomic particles, this de Broglie wavelength can become a noticeable effect. And you might imagine that's got to be very important for atomic physics and particle physics and such. So if we go to slide 6, I think I showed you this slide at the last class, but if you have a wavelength that is on the order of the size of atoms or the size of the separation of atoms, then you might expect to see diffraction. Because you can sort of think of many layers of atoms then providing many layers for things to reflect off of and give you a sort of multiple slit diffraction, if you will. And in fact, this was seen in 1927 by a guy named Clinton Davison and Lester Germer in Bell Labs, and independently by George Paget Thompson, who turns out to be J.J. Thompson's son. And you'll hear about J.J. Thompson in a little while, but he was a very, very famous British physicist who also won a Nobel Prize. At any rate, Davison and Thomson won the Nobel Prize for basically showing that you could that if you pass a beam of electrons through thin foil, that you got a diffraction pattern. And this showed very clearly that electrons exhibited wave-like characteristics completely consistent with what de Broglie suggested that they might have. So we go to slide 7. In fact, you can use the diffraction pattern to infer what it is that the electrons are diffracting from. And we've already discussed the fact that you get diffractive effects when the structure that you're bouncing off of is on the order of the size of the wavelength. As you go to shorter and shorter wavelength photons, or light, then you should be able to resolve smaller and smaller structures. And in fact, X-ray diffraction and X-ray crystallography are used to study the structure of the repetitive structure in crystals, for example, by basically using the crystals as something similar to a multiple slit grating, if you will. And so people take X-rays and bounce them off of things and look at the diffraction patterns, and there's a whole area of science known as X-ray crystallography where people use these X-rays and then bounce them off of things and then use the diffraction patterns to determine the structures of what they're bouncing off. This is very important in biology and chemistry. If you want to look at still smaller structure and maybe understand the structure of molecules and things of the such, you can also use electron diffraction or even neutron diffraction. And so these are areas of very well established areas of study that are very important for chemistry and biology. Let's go to slide 8. So here's sort of an example of you pass X-rays through a crystal and you'll get diffraction. You can look at an X-ray detector. And then the pattern can be quite complex. Over on the right-hand side, you see an example of X-ray diffraction and actually patterns that you get from electron diffraction. And you can imagine our simple little single, double, and multiple slit patterns and diffraction grating patterns are really quite simple compared to these. So the determination of structure from these patterns is a rather complex business, but people can do it, and they are actually able to determine structures of rather complex things like proteins. All right, let's go to slide 9. Another wonderful thing that we can use electrons for, if you do microscopy, remember that, again, your ability to resolve small things depends on the wavelength of the light that you're using, and you can only resolve things that are larger than the wavelength of the light that you're using. So, of course, this means practically there's a limit to resolution of an optical light microscope, and one way to push beyond this limit is to, rather than to use light as your image something, we can use a beam of electrons. And as we've already seen, that the de Broglie wavelength for an electron is enormously small, and in fact you can adjust it by changing the beam energy. So the higher the momentum, the shorter the de Broglie wavelength of the electron. And you can see on the left-hand side on slide 9 sort of a schematic of how a scanning electron microscope works. You create an electron beam, you accelerate it to whatever the energy is that you want, and then you can use magnetic coils to scan the electron around the object, and then you can collect the electrons and effectively image the object from that. And you can get resolutions down to around 1 nanometer with electron microscopes. So this is a very well-established technique and a very useful thing to do. Okay, so this is going to be the end of the material for exam 2. And this would correspond, I'll send an email out with this information, but second I'm looking at my book. This would correspond to somewhere in chapter 37. In fact, we're about to look at the Bohr model. So the exam that's coming up will cover through chapter 37, 8, section 8, and from 37, 9 on, we'll be on the next, we'll be on the final, but not covered on exam 2. Alright, but I'll send out an email that specifies everything on exam 2. Not today, maybe tomorrow, the next day. Alright, so let's go to slide 10. So it turns out that one of the reasons it's really, if you want to understand matter, we really need to understand the constituents of matter and the light that is absorbed by and or emitted by it. Because in a sense, the light that's absorbed and emitted by the matter is our real probe into the matter, and to understand this internal structure. So our concept of the atom wasn't always what we currently have. And in fact, things began to come together in the very late 1800s. You can imagine this is a really exciting time in physics with all the things going on in the late 1800s and very early 1900s. In 1897, J.J. Thomson, the same guy who was the father of the Paget-Thomson that we talked about a moment ago, he discovered electrons. He called them corpuscles, and basically he looked at cathode rays, or he was able to take a large potential difference and create a beam of electrons that passed through a fairly rarefied or in a vacuum tube, and he could manipulate it with electric fields or magnetic fields. It turns out these were beams of electrons as we know them now. J.J. Thomson called them corpuscles. Eventually the word electron stuck. That came from 1894 by a physicist named George Stoney, who coined the term electron to describe the fundamental quantity of electricity. So Thomson was an amazing physicist. He was he won the Nobel Prize in 1906 for this work. 7 of his research assistants won the Nobel Prizes. And his son also won a Nobel Prize. So it's amazing. At any rate, here in these early years, what people knew was that you could create positive ions with atoms, and as Thomson showed, you could actually isolate and create a beam out of the negative piece of the atoms. So the picture that came into play, which is, often called the plum pudding model of the atom, was basically probably the most favored model of the atom during these early years. And in this idea, you have sort of a diffuse positive charge in which you have these negative charges embedded. One of the things Thomson showed was that most of the mass was in the positive charge. So that's partly what led to this idea that you had sort of this large, diffuse, positive thing with the negative charges embedded in it. And then, if you want to talk about light being absorbed or emitted by such a thing, you can basically think of these little negative charges oscillating inside the positive charge. Let's go to slide 11. The actual fundamental charge of the electron was measured in 1913 by Robert Millikan. And how he did it was sort of cool. He basically atomized oil droplets and then used a charged metal plate to give them a positive charge, and then he found the ones that were basically balanced against the force of gravity. And because we understand this force of gravity, he was able to find, by counting these oil drops, the minimal amount of charge that that would actually balance this thing out. And then he could adjust the currents, the charge plates that you see. He could adjust the charge plates, and knowing roughly what the mass of the oil was, able to calculate what the actual electric charge was. And slide 12, extremely important development came from the lab of Ernest Rutherford. Rutherford was a New Zealand physicist. He'd actually earned the 1903 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his studies in radioactivity. But for this part of our story, what's really important was he used source of alpha particles. So Rutherford had studied naturally occurring radioactive elements, and he used a source of alpha particles. The alphas are +2 charge. They're basically helium nuclei. So we would look at them now as 2 protons and 2 neutrons. And they didn't really know what they were at the time, but they knew that they were, they knew what their charge to mass ratio was. They knew them to be heavy and heavily charged particles. And he basically used these alpha particles as a cannon, and shot as cannon shells, and basically shot these alpha particles through a thin metal foil. And the expectation, if you look where I have a blue A in a circle, if you think about what the plum pudding model is, if you were to take a +2 charged object, an alpha particle, moving at a momentum, and move it through one of these plum pudding atoms, you basically would expect to see it somewhat deflected. The angle by which it's deflected would be relatively small because the positive charge in the atom is all spread out. So at any given point, you don't see all that much, or you have a lot to one side and to the other. So within the plum pudding model of the atom, there's a fairly solid expectation of what the scattering should look like. And the scattering, as the alpha particle goes through the metal foil, should be fairly small angles. And in fact, largely they saw relatively small angle scattering. But once in a while, what they observed in Rutherford's lab in 1909 was that every now and then they got a massively large scatter. So this would correspond to the picture where I have a blue bee in a circle, where you imagine, so what Rutherford eventually decided and published in 1911, in order to account for the fact that once in a while the alpha particles were scattered through very large angles, he had to assume that most of the positive charge in the atom was actually concentrated in a small region. So if you have, for example, most of the mass and charge concentrated in a very small region within a nucleus, within the atom, then again, most of the time as the alpha particle passes through the thin foil, it doesn't generally approach the nucleus that often, because most of the foil is actually empty space, and the alpha particle may get scattered, but it's scattered because of the positive charge of nuclei, but it's not scattered that hard because it generally is going with a fairly large impact parameter with respect to the very tiny nucleus. So it's a little bit like if you're playing a game of darts from across the room. You can be a pretty good dart player, and you'll very seldom actually hit the bullseye. Most of the time, you'll actually miss by a bit. And so that would be the case here. But every now and then, you actually do hit the bullseye, or you come really, really close to that central nucleus. And in this case, when you do, the nucleus has a lot of mass, and there's a lot of charge, and so this can cause an abrupt and very dramatic change in the path of the alpha particle. It can be scattered through very large angles. And Rutherford at the time compared this to a 15-inch cannon shell being deflected by a piece of paper. So at first it really made no sense, because the picture of the atom people had in the days, it just didn't work. So in order for Rutherford to account for this kind of data, for his data, he was able to infer that the mass and the positive charge in the nucleus was concentrated in a region that was around 10 to the minus 15 meters in radius. So that's really tiny. And this meant that the atom itself was really largely empty space. And Rutherford proposed that, this proposal is called the nuclear model of the atom, where all the positive charge is at this, and the mass is really at the center. And somehow the negative charges are around, but there wasn't a real clear picture beyond that. Now, it turns out that during this period of around 1911, when Rutherford was deriving the nuclear model of his atom, there was a guy named Niels Bohr, who was a postdoc in Rutherford's lab. And Niels moved on. He was a Danish physicist. To go to slide 13. And he developed a detailed model of the atom. Remember, you can say that all the positive charge is concentrated at the very center, and that maybe the electrons are moving around on the outside, and you might argue that they're moving around on the outside in circles, because that's the simplest thing. But remember that if you look at the light that's emitted by hot atoms or absorbed by hot atoms, you don't see continuous frequencies. What you see are very discrete frequencies, and this really is at the time is the biggest puzzle in trying to understand the nature of matter. And Niels Bohr concocted a model of an atom that was inspired by Rutherford's nuclear model, and then he put in pieces to also account for the discrete spectra. So if we look at the bottom of 13, Niels Bohr invented this atomic, you might call it even a planetary model, which he set it up so that it had very fixed orbits. And turns out that, we'll talk about it a bit, his fixing of the orbits was a little, he has only specific discrete orbits that work in the Bohr model. And where Bohr was concerned, it was a little bit ad hoc. He sort of decided to set up the atom this way. He quantized something so that it would actually describe the data, but it wasn't particularly well motivated. And what we'll find is that it becomes really pretty well motivated once de Broglie's hypothesis came around. All right, let's go to slide 14 and look more closely at the Bohr model of the atom. In particular, Bohr assumed that there is a positive nucleus that is very small, and that the electrons orbit the nucleus in circles. So, and then he said that the electrons orbit the nucleus in circles, but only in very particular orbits, which is what we call quantization. So only these certain discrete orbits are allowed. And the essence of what holds the electron in the atom orbiting the nucleus is the Coulomb force. So that's the basic idea. So let's look at slide 15. And what I'd like to do is to derive basic physical quantities from Bohr's assumptions. And this is as you'll see, we're going to use classical assumptions to make these derivations. So we're going to assume, for example, that an electron going around an atom in a circle is just like a particle moving in a circle, so that we use basic Newtonian mechanics to look at the dynamics of the system. At the same time, we will put in quantization, which comes in by in an ad hoc way with Bohr, or once you think your way through de Broglie, you can use the de Broglie wavelength and sort of motivate how the quantization comes in. So what we have with the Bohr model is something that is a mix of both classical and quantum hypotheses. And in that sense, it's really quite unsatisfactory, right? The electron is clearly treated as a particle and treated as a wave in the same derivation. So in that sense, the Bohr model is explicitly wrong. But what you're going to see is that it works really well. Amazingly well, in a sense. And we're going to solve for the allowed energies and orbits and things for electrons in a formal quantum mechanical sense with a consistent theory. But what we'll find is that your intuition about atoms is served pretty well by the Bohr model. So it turns out that it is conceptually, and even in terms of your intuition, it's a very important model. So we're going to spend a bit of time on it today. So Niels Bohr proposed his model in 1913, and we're on slide 15. So he assumes that the electrons move in circles around a positive nucleus, and generally, we can allow the nucleus to have multiple charges, so we don't. But for some of this discussion, I'll be assuming it's just hydrogen, so it would have Z of 1, or positive 1 charge in the center. But if we had a larger nucleus, we could have a larger Z. And that's actually not an issue. Bohr's model is completely consistent with that. But one thing that Bohr does is he has only a single electron in the atom. So in a sense, the Bohr model describes atomic hydrogen. It describes the helium plus one ion. So you have just the one electron, etc. At any rate, so we have an electron moving around a circle. You have a centripetal force toward the center, which is equal to the Coulomb force. The centripetal force, classically, is mv squared over r, where m is the mass of the electron. And then we can set that equal to the Coulomb force toward the center, which will be k times, remember, kqq over r squared, but qq, in this case, is just the absolute value of the electric charge, which I'll just call E here. So that would be ke squared over r squared. And the only difference here, if we have a larger nucleus, is instead of ke squared, we'd have k times ze times e, so it'd be kze squared over r squared. So we have the Coulomb attraction between the proton and the electron on the left-hand side, and we have the centripetal force on the right-hand side, and I'm going to call this equation, which is at the bottom of slide 15, equation 1. So let's go to slide 16. Now comes the quantization. Imagine that we have the electron moving in a circle, and that the electron is a wave. It has a wavelength. Then I'd like to use our classical notion of standing waves. Remember that for standing waves, what we found was that for a given tension and length of a string, if we fixed it at both ends, we found that only particular wavelengths would interfere constructively. Right, you'd have a traveling wave down the string. It would reflect. Upon reflection with a fixed end, you would have a 180-degree phase change, and you would have constructive interference when you had a very particular wavelength. And we solved for the particular frequencies or wavelengths that would give you this constructive interference given the boundary conditions and this tension and mass gradient length of the string. And at the time, what I said is this is basically a quantization of music. Music is the quantization of a sound. So what I meant by that was for given conditions of this string, not all frequencies would play well. Only discrete frequencies would. So therefore, it's quantized. It's those frequencies where you get resonance, where you have the constructive interference between the traveling and the reflected wave. So now imagine instead of a string which is fixed at both ends, we take those two ends and we fold them in on each other. And it's hard to imagine this with a string, but imagine that we now have this string in a circle and we have a wave traveling around the circle. So if the wave is, in a sense, always being generated as it goes around the circle, those waves where, as it goes around the circle, it comes back completely in phase with where it's being generated, you'll have constructive interference. And waves with different wavelengths will, in a sense, interfere with themselves as they travel around this string, and they will not resonate. So a way to imagine it is we say that you will have resonance, or you'll have constructive interference for waves where the length around the circle, 2 pi r, where I have the blue A in a circle, 2 pi r is equal to some integral number of wavelengths. Then, in fact, you might imagine that you'll have constructive interference as the wave propagates around the circle. And you'll get, you can imagine drawing pictures like I have on the right-hand side of slide 16. So what this says is that for only very particular wavelengths at a given radius, would you expect things to be stable. So 2 pi r is equal to some integral number of wavelengths where n is 1, 2, 3, etc. And this stable wave piece basically is inspired by de Broglie. And so we can now take this 2 pi r is equal to n lambda. We can use de Broglie's relationship to rewrite lambda in terms of h over p. Take out your decoder rings. You're used to saying Planck's constant. Turns out very often people take h and there's a reason to divide it by 2 pi, and that's something which we call h bar, and it's written as I have written it, where we have a blue C in a circle in the middle of the page. So the quantization in the Bohr model, if you use the inspiration from de Broglie, is that you basically have a standing circular wave. And because it's a standing wave, which means it has to be constructive as you go around, only integral multiples work. Well, remember that de Broglie was sort of mid-20s, and Bohr actually came up with the model in 1913. So this really isn't what Bohr said, okay? What Bohr did was he quantized angular momentum. So look where I have a D in a blue D in a circle in the middle of the page. If we if we take the expression, which we have where I have a blue B in a circle, 2 pi r is equal to nh over p, and we put in h bar, so that's dividing out the 2 pi, so we substitute h bar for h, and then we pull the p over to the other side, we get p times r is equal to nh bar. Well, momentum is mv, so we have mvr is equal to nh bar, and if you are thinking of something moving in a circle and you see mvr, that's basically what we mean when we say angular momentum, classically. And this was really what Bohr did. Bohr quantized the angular momentum, and you might say, well, why in the world would you ever do that? At least the whole inspiration from de Broglie makes sense. And, well, Bohr was being a great physicist, right? He knew that if you have this nuclear atom, he basically was wanting to quantize the light that the thing could emit or not. So he had to put in some form of quantization in these orbits. He had to make them stable. So it was sort of an ad hoc thing he threw in. Be it as it may, let's look at what happens. So if we look where I have a blue E in a circle, we have mvr is equal to nh bar, let's solve for v, and we get equation 2. And I want to take that, and if you look back on page 15, I want to substitute this expression for v, which is nh bar over m times r. I want to substitute it into the equation 1 on page 15. And when I do that, we get what is at the top of page 17. Where I have a blue A in a circle. And so this is starting to look sort of nasty. You've got lots of things, lots of R's and stuff everywhere. So what I want to do is take this expression and just solve for R. So when you do that, we get where I have a blue B in a circle. We have R sub N, R meaning R where N is specified to be whatever it is, 1, 2, 3, etc. So if we solve for R sub N, we get N squared H bar squared over K E squared M. And here, since N has to be an integer, what it's saying is that only particular radii exist. You'll have R1 or R2 or R3. Where you substitute in for whatever the integer in for the n that's in the equation where I have a blue B in a circle. If you have an atomic number of Z, okay, so you have an atom where you have the larger nucleus, but you remember we still have to have the single electron in it, then the KE squared of R squared becomes the KZEE over R squared. And so that basically takes the expression where we have the blue B in a circle, and it becomes the blue C in a circle, where we have the Z down below. If you set N equal to 1, we call it the ground state. Why, we'll see in a minute. Turns out to correspond to the lowest energy state. Then you can write R sub N in terms of R sub 1 as N squared over Z times R sub 1. So the radii for the different allowed orbitals are quantized. And they'll be different for different nuclear charges. In fact, they'll be smaller by factor Z. Which makes some sense, because if you have more charge at the center of the atom, you're going to hold the electron tighter. You might imagine it would make the orbit smaller. Okay, so let's go to slide 18, and let's ask, if we have this sort of situation, what's the kinetic energy of the electron? Well, the kinetic energy is defined classically to be 1/2 mv squared, and now we can substitute N for V from equation 2 at the bottom of page 16. So V becomes nh bar over mr, and we substitute that in, and then we can Also substitute N for R from page 17, because you remember we now have in the middle of page 17 an expression for R sub N. So when we substitute in for all that, we get the kinetic energy is equal to this expression where I have a blue B in a circle. So the kinetic energy is mk squared z squared e to the fourth over 2n squared h bar squared. Now the total energy is the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. And let's think about what the potential energy is. Remember, the potential energy of the charge is effectively how much work it takes to bring the charge in from infinity. Right? That would be the potential of the electron in the atom. Would be, suppose you had the bare nucleus, and we now ask, how much energy does it take to bring the electron in from infinity and put it at that radius? Right? That's what we mean when we say electric potential or the potential energy. So we know how to do that from physics 122 or 142. Potential energy is minus kz e squared over r for a nucleus of charge z. So if we take that potential energy and we substitute in for r, then we get the expression that we have for, or I have a blue D in a circle at the bottom of page 18. So there's an expression for potential energy. We have the kinetic energy in the middle of the page on page 18. And now what I want to do is to just add those two together to get the total energy, which is what we do at the top of slide 19. And what you see is that the energy for E sub n, I'll call it, for the nth, for whatever n happens to be, the total energy is this minus mk squared z squared e to the fourth over 2n squared h squared, where I'm looking at the equation where I have a blue B in a circle on slide 19. Okay, so we have this total energy. If you look at all these quantities in this expression, the mass is positive, k squared, z squared, e to the fourth, n squared, h bar, h squared, everything is positive, which means this minus sign that is in this expression makes this a negative energy. What does that mean? Does that bother you at all? I mean, what do we really mean when we start talking about negative energy? I want you to think about that for a minute. We have this electron in a circle around the nucleus, and we say that it has a negative energy. What does that mean? Let's go to slide 20. I remind you, right, what we really mean. It's not, you've seen negative energies before, right? Because it takes negative work to take an electron from infinity and bring it in and put it at a distance r from a positive charge. That's, remember, when you calculate the potential, or the potential is the work per unit charge it takes to create that system, whatever it is. It takes negative energy to move it in, because basically the positive charge is attracting the negative charge. So you have to hold it back as you move it in order to create the system. So what it really means is that you're gaining energy by putting these two things together. So slide 21. So what it really means, this negative, it means that the electron is bound in the nucleus. It means that it is energetically happy to be there, and you have to put work into the system to remove it. which you already know. If you have an electron at a distance r from a nucleus, those are happily attracted to one another. And even classically, right, if in electromagnetism, if you now want to take this electron and move it away from the nucleus, you have to put energy into the system because you have to do work against the Coulomb force to pull it away. So when we have this negative energy, it means that we have a bound state, and we have to put energy into the system if we want to free the electron. And when we talk about atoms, we say we ionize the atom in such a case. So if we set Z equal to 1, so I'm on slide 21, if we set Z equal to 1, that corresponds to atomic hydrogen, and if we let N equal to 1, we will get the lowest energy that we can get. If we look at slide 19, the most negative number you're going to get here corresponds to where N is equal to 1. If N is equal to 2, it'll be that number. It'll be a negative number, but it will be divided by 4 in magnitude. So that means it's, in a sense, it's less of a negative number than the E1 is. Go back to slide 21. So if we set N equal 1, then we get the energy of the most bound electron in hydrogen. And when we calculate out what that energy is using all the constants that we had in our equation, we get it to be at negative 13.6 electron volts. This turns out to be a number that you should just commit to memory. It is the simplest atomic system you can have, and the energy in that system is minus 13.6 eV. What it says is that to ionize atomic hydrogen in its ground state, to blast that electron away from the nucleus, you have to inject 13.6 electron volts worth of energy. So why do I care about the ground state of the hydrogen atom, you might ask? What's so special about that? Well, that's the simplest atomic system. Everything else is really just scales from that. I can change Z. If I change Z, I bind things tighter, but basically it's just a scale factor from the hydrogen atom. So you can think of this as something that sets the scale for atomic processes, for things where you're changing how the electron is arranged in an atom. Since chemistry is really nothing more than rearrangements of electrons about atoms as you regroup things, energy changes that happen in chemistry tend to also be roughly of the scale of this 13.6 eV. So this quantity, in a sense, sets the whole scale for atomic physics and chemistry in terms of all the energy changes. So I think it's pretty important. At any rate, if we want to think of the energy of the nth level and we want to allow the Z of the nucleus to change, then we get the equation below where I have the circle equation in red. E sub N is equal to Z squared over N squared times E1. So the picture you get for the energy levels is on the right-hand side on slide 21. N equal 1 is the lowest energy state. N equal 2 is also negative, but it is less negative than N equal 1, and it should be a factor of 4 closer to 0 than the N equal 1 state. N equal 3 is also negative, but it's closer to 0 than N equal 2, so it is less bound in a sense. The electron that is in the N equal 3 state has more energy than the electron in the N equal 1 state. And another really important piece of the Bohr model, which I don't think I put earlier, but is an extremely important piece. What Bohr said is that when the electron absorbs or emits quanta of light as it moves from one energy level to another, and it is only those energy differences that can correspond to the photon energies. How do I say that? You have only those orbits that are allowed, so atoms will only absorb or emit light at the frequencies that correspond to the photon energies that are the differences between these energy levels. So the picture one needs to have in your head at the on the right-hand side of slide 21, if an electron is in a lower energy orbit, such as n=1, if it absorbs a photon which has exactly the energy between the n=1 and n=3 energy state, then the electron will absorb the photon and jump up to the n=3 state. If it's in the n=3 state, it can drop down to a lower energy orbit, but when it does, it has to, by energy conservation, it has to release the amount of energy, which is the difference between those two energy levels. And again, Bohr puts quantum mechanics in his model by saying that atoms absorb and emit photons, not classical electromagnetic radiation, but actual quanta. So the quantum mechanics gets thrown in at this point as well. So let's go to slide 22. So now what you get, So if we look where I have a blue A in a circle, we have a drawing of various energy states. This would be for the hydrogen atom. And if we have white light incident on a hydrogen atom, for example, then there are certain transitions that are allowed. You can go from n=1 up to n=2. You can go from n=1 to n=3, n=1 to n=4, etc. Or you could start at n=2 and go up to n=3, n=2 and go up to n=4, etc. And it's only these very particular transitions that are allowed. And if you shine white light onto a gas of hydrogen, these particular frequencies will be absorbed, and you'll actually have these particular frequencies disappear from the spectrum. So what I have pictured at the bottom left of slide 22 would be what's known as an absorption spectrum of hydrogen. So if we look where I have a B in a circle, if we say that for Z=1 hydrogen, what is the frequency of the absorption line corresponding to a transition between the n=2 and n=4? Well, the frequency of the absorption line would correspond to the frequency that gives the energy, which is the difference between those two levels. So we're talking hydrogen, so Z is equal to 1, and the energy difference between these two levels would be 1 over n squared times E1, where n is equal to 4, minus 1 over n squared times E1, where n is equal to 2. So we'd have 1/16 E1 minus 1/4 E1. So we then substitute in what E1 is. For the hydrogen atom, it's minus 13.6. And we end up with the energy of the photon to be equal to 2.55 eV. So I can convert that energy into frequency by using H, where I've put H in eV seconds, as I mentioned earlier, probably would do. In eV seconds, H is 4.13 times 10 to the minus 15. And this corresponds to a frequency of 6.2 times 10 to the 14, which corresponds to a wavelength of 4.8 times 10 to minus 7. That's 480 nanometers. That one's in the blue-green. So let's go to slide 23. If we were to plot out the energy spectrum for hydrogen, so let us imagine that we heat hydrogen up and by heating it up, we send the electron into higher energy levels, and those electrons then can cascade down, and when they do, they will emit light at frequency that corresponds to the energy difference between the levels that it makes a transition from. And when we do that, you get the spectrum, which would then be called an emission spectrum. On slide 23, the emission spectrum and the absorption spectrum have their lines at exactly the same places, but the physical process is just different. So we'll talk about that a little in the next slide. At any rate, if we allow n equal to 1 and we calculate the energies, the frequencies that you'll see, we get what's known as the Lyman series, which is shown in the figure. If you allow n equal to 2, you get the Balmer series. You allow n equal to 3, you get the Paschen series. So n equal 2, for example, would correspond to the frequencies of light where higher energy states all jump down to the n equal 2 state. So if we do things a little, if you look at what I did on slide 22 on the right-hand side, I basically determined the wavelength for light that corresponded to a particular transition. Often what's done, one of the ways people look at this is they calculate 1 over the wavelength, which is the frequency, and they generally write that as R times the difference between the 1 over the 1 over n squares for the two different levels during the transition. And if you look carefully on slide 22 and compare to what we're writing on slide 23, you can find that there's this quantity which is written in the equations as R, which would correspond to E1 divided by HC, which is what you would need to convert the E1 into 1 over lambda with lambda in meters on the left-hand side. When you write it this way, the constant that you have, which is this E1 over HC, is called Rydberg, the Rydberg constant. And again, we haven't really conceptually done anything that we hadn't done earlier. It's just often when people write it this way. So you'll hear the Rydberg constant, and it's nothing magical. It's just this way of looking at the transition, the wavelength of the transition energies between systems, between different states allowed in the atom. Let's go to slide 24. So we've talked about the difference between emission and absorption. That's really illustrated in the figure in the top middle of slide 24. You can imagine that we have white light passing through a grating or a prism, and we get a continuous spectrum where we have a blue A in a circle. If we were to take a hot gas where we heat it up, the electron goes into high energy states and then makes transitions from the high energy states down to the lower energy states, emitting light, then you get what's known as emission line spectrum, which is where we have a blue B in a circle. So this would correspond physically, for example, to discrete jumps from the higher level energies down to one of the lower level energies, sort of as in the diagram that I have on the upper right on slide 24. So one of these jumps, for example, from, say, n equal 2 down to n equal 1 would correspond to a very particular frequency very particular color, which is what you would see on the emission line spectrum on the slide B. If you sort of reverse the process by having cold gas and you pass the light through it so that the light gets absorbed where the electron gets kicked from the lower energy state up to the higher energy state, then you get the absorption line spectrum where we have the blue C in a circle. And note that the line positions are identical in the emission line and the absorption line spectrum. They're sort of different ways of looking at things. The other day when I passed out the gradings in class and we saw the discrete colored lines that were coming out of the various gas lamps, what we were looking at were atomic emission line spectra. So I think the particular atoms that I had a white light, sort of a tungsten light, where the emission was continuous, and you saw a pretty rainbow that the grating then made for you and spread out to different orders. But then we looked at hydrogen and helium and sodium and argon, I think we did. And one of the things you'll note is that, which I hope you saw, is that each of these different atomic gases, when excited, emitted light. So we saw emission spectra, but the pattern of colors that was emitted was different in each of those, which should make sense because what you're doing is you are looking at a different set of energy levels in each of these atoms. If we assume that the world really was described by the Bohr model, and if we neglected the fact that we have multiple electrons in these atoms, let us suppose, and this isn't true, but let us suppose that what we were looking at were these different gas lamps we were looking at a single electron in the atom, so these were heavily ionized for the heavier atoms. Then, in fact, the spectra would still look different because you'd have that Z factor, which would change the energies of all the energy levels. And that Z factor is different for each of the atoms. Life is more complicated than this. The Bohr model is not perfect, and we will discuss all those complications. But the cool thing is that for a very particular atom, you have a characteristic set of frequencies that correspond to these energy differences between the energy levels allowed in the atom. And if we look at the bottom middle of slide 24, in fact, you can see spectra for mercury and sodium and helium and hydrogen, and you can barely see the lines, I guess, in the slide. But each of these patterns is quite different. But it's always the same. So hydrogen that we saw in Hoyt, when you hit it with energy and it glows at very particular spectral lines, will be the same as hydrogen in the sun, which is the same as hydrogen on Alpha Centauri, or hydrogen in the middle of a cold gas cloud in the middle of interstellar space. If you have a bright star and you have a thin hydrogen cloud between us and the star so that you can see some of the starlight, that cloud will absorb. If it's a hydrogen cloud, it will absorb the spectral lines that correspond to the hydrogen spectral lines, and you can actually know that you're passing that light through hydrogen. So these spectral lines really do correspond to atomic fingerprints, and there's lots of really cool stuff that one can do with that. At any rate, I think this is the end of the material that I wanted to cover for this lecture, so I hope this turns out to be okay. Please email me if you have questions, and I'll try to respond. I'm on Japan time, so I'm running about, I guess, 13 hours ahead of you right now. So there could be some weirdness in terms of when I respond to any emails that you send. And I will have one more lecture to prepare for you for this week, and I want to send you emails specifying information about the exam. But basically, you already see what we're going to do. What we're going to cover is everything that we have looked at since the end of the material for the last exam, all the way up to basically the start of atomic models today. So we're going to the pre the pre-Bohr, pre... So through de Broglie, up to slide... So slide 10 of today's lecture would correspond to the first material for beyond this exam. So black body radiation, photoelectric effect, resolution, de Broglie, all that stuff would be fair game for this coming test. And the reason that I'm doing that is because that's material that's in this week's workshops that you guys are doing and this week's problem set. The Bohr model and things like that will be on following workshop and problem sets, and I want to make sure I will only cover on the exam things where you have had a chance to do the workshop problems and the problem set problems. At any rate, so that's it for me. So I hope you're having a good weekend. Bye.